Welcome back to Global South, a program bridging the gaps between developing countries and us here at home. My name is Catherine Seal, and over the last 4 months, you've been listening to some pretty special people from Kisumu, Kenya, each with their views on Kenya's history, present-day issues, and what the future holds in store both at home and abroad. Subjects dealing with colonialism, economics, corruption, and employment challenges. You are currently listening to part four of a four-part series of interviews with local Kenyans doing incredible works in their own country. Today, we'll be listening to Collins Kodik. Collins grew up in the slums of Manyata, just outside of Kisumu, and he's married with one child. He holds a bachelor's degree in anthropology from Mizzou University and a diploma in chemical engineering, and is currently furthering his studies in political economics. In his words, he believes that global poverty is a large extent, not by default, but by design, by way of collusion between the West and various beneficiaries in Africa. He is persuaded that neocolonialism can be defeated both through local and international cooperation. Locally, when the poor can express their consciousness through innovation, creativity, production, and strengthening of participatory government systems, when they have the platforms through which they can voice their concerns, and when their governments can bargain globally as partners and co-equals. He perceives Kenya and Africa at the brink of being auctioned by the West, and most immediately by China. The meager earnings of the African worker continue to be subject to increasing taxes to pay back questionable loans. He envisions local and global communities that uphold the dignity, freedom, and inclusivity of members, and where women and young people can live to the fullest realization of their potentials, rights, dreams, and privileges. Collins was interviewed prior to the 2017 Kenya elections in Kisumu, Kenya, on the shores of Lake Victoria, the second largest lake in Africa. We are situated in the gym upstairs at the Acacia Hotel, overlooking the outdoor pool. The gym is tucked away from the hustle and bustle of the lobby, and for a time we are uninterrupted. This interview is unedited, and I hope you enjoy. Good morning. We're here at Kisumu City at Acacia Hotel, and we're having a conversation with Collins here. And he's going to go ahead and introduce himself, and we'll continue on with our interview on entrepreneurship, colonialism, and everything in between.
Kathy, my name is Collins Kodik. I am a third born in a family of six. I was born and raised in this beautiful city of Kisumu, Kenya, in a slum called Manyata. I'm a student at Maseno University, currently studying sociology and anthropology. Previously, I have a degree in chemical engineering. My shift to sociology and anthropology is based on my passion in serving my community. At the community level, I am a community organizer, and I support community groups in developing initiatives that will change the face of our town. I work closely with women and youths, and I am the human rights activist and coordinator for this for Kisumu County. I'm particularly connected to issues that affect children, particularly girl children, that make it very difficult for them to attain the highest possible aspirations that one would want in life. That is what I do within my community.
Okay, thank you. That sounds great. Now, you and I had a conversation some time ago back at Mizzou University in regards to, you know, things like colonialism and where Kenya stands today. Yeah. And I think everything you're doing in the community kind of relates to all of that, because I know you had some pretty good opinions about what you thought. And I'm just wondering today if you would share some of those opinions that you shared with me some time ago.
Well, I think we need to begin by appreciating that Africa and Kenyans, we are living on a borrowed culture. The culture we are practicing today is not our culture. It is not a culture that we got inducted into willingly. We were coerced to take this culture, to take this route of living. So definitely there are a lot of challenges and difficulties in fitting into this new system of things that was handed over to us by colonialists. 50 years after independence, Kenya is faced with very difficult times. Communities within Kenya, or ethnic communities, are finding it very difficult to live cohesively as they did before the colonialists came. History teaches us that we previously lived as one people, borrowing and sharing and doing trade before the colonialists came. But the colonialists came and taught us about boundaries. The colonialists came and taught us about the difference of tribe based on language. The colonialists came and taught us about capitalism, which is not African way of life, and set us on a course of collision. That is the genesis of the problems that face us today. We are competing and killing each other for no apparent reason. Ethnic communities that are in power are amassing wealth primitively and are corrupting their ways to access and retain power. This is some of the things that are affecting Kenya deeply. Mm. Yes.
You know, it's interesting, and you know, everything you say I concur with. And, you know, there's a question out there in regards to corruption and whether or not corruption was actually created out of colonialism. I'm wondering if you might be able to make a comment on that.
But that's true. It should not be whether or not. The reality is corruption is foreign in African concept. There is no corruption. Corruption is a foreign concept brought to us. You look at how Africans, my forefathers stayed. They practiced redistribution of resources such that we did not have class status, where we had some people classified as poor, other middle class, and other rich. We did not have that in our traditional communities. These are things that have been put to us by the white, who have made others appear servants, others are bosses, and others are struggling in between. That is not African. So everybody is trying to be at the top, because if you're at the top, you get the privileges of capitalist life. This is foreign, and this is capitalistic. The form of government that we have. Today, you look, in Kenya, communities are more divided than ever before. We just had the post-election violence following the 2007 election, which split this country to the core. We are going into an election coming, and the same thing. The people funding these elections and the observers who watch over these elections are from the West. And I think they are happy about it. They're very happy about it, because the more divided we are, the more they can thrive. They can strike business deals with the corrupt government leaders. So they have formed cartels. We think that much of our problem has been thrust on us.
Next question I have is, when we talk about colonialism and the issues that colonialism brought to Africa, so not just Kenya, but Africa, and we could actually say the rest of the developing world, because everybody's having the same similar problems to one form or another, depending on how you look at various cultures. One question that was brought up in the West is, without colonialism, where would Africa be today?
Without colonialism, Africa will be good. Our rivers will be there, safe. Our environment will be safe. Our animals will not be poached. Without colonialism, we would have a system of governance that appreciates every member of the community. Without colonialism, we will be one, and unity is more important to us.
So we've got a little bit of the historical aspect there. So what about today? How would you go about fixing the issues that are going on?
I think it's the responsibility of every generation to lift up itself above the ashes of abuse and ashes of frustration. And I think a new generation of Africans are coming up, not just in Kenya, in South Africa, in Nigeria, in Ghana, and a new generation is coming up who have evaluated the system and said, no, we cannot rely on the same people who used the same level of knowledge to bring us where we are. We need a new generation of people to change it. And we need a new set, a paradigm shift. We cannot work with this model. We have tried it for over 50 years. It is splitting us. It is hurting us. So Africans are coming, the young people coming in innovating ways. The young people who are challenging the dominance of multinationals in agriculture, in manufacturing. Young people are coming, and at the moment it is in a small way, but I am sure it is going to catch fire. Mm. People are coming to realization that we owe it to ourselves to be free.
One of the biggest issues that I understand here is, you know, the unemployment rate is still quite high. But I also know that Kenyans are very well-educated people. And unfortunately, we have many people coming out of the universities and colleges here in Kenya and are not employed. They're not employable. I mean, what can you talk about in regards to that? What is the next step?
I think we need to appreciate that fairly and largely Kenyans are educated. And I think that's what cuts us from the rest of Africa. We have a very high population that is informed and that has skills that can compete. However, we need to understand that, one, unemployment was not an issue in traditional Africa. Unemployment is a mess we have caught up because as an after effect of colonialism. How are we going to solve this? The colonialists cheated us that we go to school to get employed. So we left all our work, all our subsistence to go for white-collar jobs. But you look at it, we have realized that white-collar jobs are not enough and is a form of imprisonment. So as it is, Africans everywhere, and Kenya in particular, we have a reason. Youths have a reason, women have a reason. They are forming groups, they are forming circles, and some even individually are challenging it. They are creating opportunities. And I think much sensitization needs to go in that direction, that we must learn to solve our own problems. And a solution to a problem can be entrepreneurial, can change people. We must learn to create new industries, which might not be in the Western nature, but which are responsive to our own problems. And I think that is the way to go. There are people coming up, and I know that Africans are going to solve their problem, not just by relying on government, but the people down here must begin solving the problems at the lower level.
You know, we talk about entrepreneurship, solving economic problems, certain dilemmas. It's a very dynamic issue when we talk about poverty, talking about poor governance, talking about colonialism. There's many different dynamics that, have created the situation that Africa is in. You know, we can talk about the IMF, we can talk about the World Bank, we can talk about certain agendas put in place politically. It's a big thing for Africa to cope with. And I find that not just Kenya, but Africa in itself is being looted terribly for natural resources. And competing on the global market is an issue when you're competing with people from the West that have the money and the power to take these resources. How do Kenyans, how do Africans look at that and how can they stop it?
I get your point, and we need to agree that our challenges are both at the international level and at the national level. Mm-hmm. And we also need to accept that the world system has also created a corrupt and elite Africans and African leaders who cooperate with the multinationals to rob their own people. How are we going to escape this? We might not do it today fully or tomorrow fully, but we must begin the process. How are we going to begin the process? We must, for example, educate that peasant woman to go back to farming, even if it is farming for domestic use. Mm-hmm. That alone will go a long way. If we embraced ideas like urban farming, if we took the local, and I think you're aware, if you're in Kisumu, we've had a very big issue with the cotton industry. And, for a long time, our government embraced the second-hand clothing from the West, which killed our cotton industry. But right now, communities are coming up and saying, well, we appreciate globalization, but we must think of Africa and Kenya first. We must revive our industry, and whatever comes from the West should come as secondary, only to supplement. But the bulk of what we use, what we consume, must be our own. Importantly, I think Africans and Kenyans must come to have a sense of pride, and not negative pride, but pride in the positive, that we appreciate who we are, and we are equal people like any other person, and we must love what is our own. I think that's been one of our biggest challenges.
You know, that's something that I understand, and you know something, the more people I talk to who are educated and certainly aware of what's going on around the world have that same opinion. But what about the people that do live below the poverty line, you know, the 45 to 50% of the population here that really don't have that privilege of post-secondary education or even a grade 12, for that matter, that still look at the West as a savior? How do we get to them?
I think every country has cases of people who are not inclined towards education. But everybody wants skill. So I think life skills are more important. Mm-hmm. Even for people who have not gone to primary or have not acquired secondary education, we need to give them life skills. Mm-hmm. It does not stop them from doing business. Yeah. You can do business from any point. It does not stop them from being basketry, from doing pottery.
Yeah.
These are industries that we can tap into today. And Catherine, I want you to get my key focus here. Mm-hmm. We might not change this thing instantly at the national or global perspective. But if we begin with that woman down there who initially had to rely on relief food, who initially had to look for donors and people that she really is not related to support her, to begin her own initiative, if we solve it with one person, this one person will lead the neighbor and they will realize the beauty in owning your very own, you know, in doing your own production and in making your own livelihood. Mm. I think this is what counts.
You know, Collins, I think what you're saying is absolutely right on the mark. I got to throw something else in there, though, because I think what I was trying to get at was attitudes. Mm. And, you know, I have a fellow who drives me around on a Peaky Peaky. And for those people in the West that don't know what Peaky Peakies are, yes, they're motorbikes. Mm. And they're kind of the poor man's taxi, in according to Western philosophy. Mm. However, this particular fellow, very lovely fellow, you know, stated that, you know, the West was great. The West was great. They give us everything we need. Mm. You know, when I arrive here, I have a lot of people, especially poor people, asking me for 25 bob, asking me for donations of motorbikes and cars because they feel that I can afford to put all this money out and whatnot. Mm. So, yes, we need to build life skills and we need to train people. Mm. But what about attitudes? How do we start changing the attitudes? Because that's really, to me, a big part of the issue.
I think we can change attitudes. And I want to tell you what I'm doing at a personal level. Mm. I grew up in a town slum. If you come to my place, I have a greenhouse that I have not purchased, but I have built it, I've fabricated it. And every morning, I fetch my vegetables and sell to my neighbors. Over time, other youths are also doing the same. And I think the best way to change attitude is by practice. But we also need people who speak the truth from the West. We do not want people who say that the West is giving to Africa because Africa is desperate, Africa is poor. I know there are billionaires and trillionaires in the U.S., for instance, but they are also poor people. They are people who live below a dollar a day in other areas in the U.S. Why can't they support those people first before they come to support us? That tells you that their intention of support is not real, is not genuine, because why pass a poor people who is your neighbor in the U.S. and move to another continent to support these poor people?
Yeah. You know, that opens up a whole another can of worms. It's a whole another issue. And, you know, a lot of people from the West have even questioned our own politicians about that. You know, the U.S. and Canada sends millions of dollars every year to developing countries. And yet, I remember at a presentation yesterday, you know, you have 45 million people living in the United States who are poor. So why aren't those people not being helped? Why is that money that is being effective or apparently effective in Africa not used to help those people, you know?
So you see, it's propaganda, you know. Today they're giving us Tom's shoes, tomorrow they are giving us relief food, there's WFP trucks running all over. The idea is to blind us. to make them appear so good, but they are stealing from us. They are doing this with our leaders at the government. And I tell you, Africa has enough. Even if we didn't receive donor aid, we have enough. And we have enough. Our internal challenges will be corruption and wastage, but we have enough. Yep. Let it not be conceived that we do not have enough, we have to depend on somebody. We have enough. And the West needs what we have. If you look at areas where Africa is rich, where there is oil, where there is uranium, where there is tin, there's conflict in all these areas. Who is supplying these war weapons? It is the West. Why do we lack war in areas which have no minerals? So the West is here, and it's here to rob us. And I think we need more ambassadors to tell Africa to begin realizing that we have a brother in the West, but the brother does not really mean very well. Mm. He does not mean very well. No. Because every time he comes, we have chaos in our house.
Yeah, you know, I was talking to the Dean of Social Development and Strategic Studies from Mizzino University, and she was a very interesting lady to talk to, and was brought up, of course, in Kenya and educated over in the United States, and then, you know, like yourself, wants to now become a part of the community to better her own people. And the one thing that she stated to me was, you know, if Africa were to close their doors, and if the West was not allotted any of those natural resources, and overnight Africa became very rich, you know, from trade from within, and, you know, whatever else, the United States would be in a lot of trouble. And I just I just don't want to say point at the United States, but a lot of Western countries who consume products, natural resources from Africa would be in trouble, because they have to utilize those natural resources in order to facilitate their own economy. So if you shut the door, who then becomes a superpower? Africa.
Africa, of course.
Yeah.
Think we are a sleeping giant. Huh? We are a sleeping giant, and soon we are waking up. You look at some of the designer clothes that you buy in stores in the West. They are made by EPZ, export processing zones, in cheap in countries like Africa, where you exploit our labor and you exploit our raw materials, and then you sell them as designers in the other end. So Africa is very rich. But Catherine, it will be unfair also not to talk about the media, how media is used to escalate this propaganda. I know the media talks. Kenya is ranked among one of the most corrupt countries in the world. But the media does not tell us about success stories of young people in Africa who are doing great things. Why is the media so negative about us? Why doesn't the media appreciate that we have our challenges, but we also have our glory? Mm-hmm. Why doesn't the media tell us of young people who are doing great things, of women who are doing extremely good, of stable African families as opposed to Western families? Why isn't the media talking on this? I don't know. Maybe you'd tell me. You've been to the West.
Well, you know, I think the only thing that I can say, and you've already said it, is propaganda. And I mean, now we can focus in on the global aid culture. And I think a lot of it has to deal around money. Again, it's an infusion of Western culture, and they need Western support.
And look at it this way. Libya is now receiving relief food. Mm. In the days of Muammar Gaddafi, there was no relief food for Libya.
Yes, please expound on this, because I think a lot of people in the West really need to understand the other side of the story here.
Yes, Muammar Gaddafi probably was a bad leader, but he was a bad leader for the West. He was good for his people. They had education, they had oil, they had water,
free
health care, free
power,
and there was no unemployment in Libya. Infrastructure was good. And the people were not complaining. The West were complaining. But Gaddafi was not their leader. What did they do? They shot and killed that guy and put that nation in disarray. How many lives have been lost as a result of that? Yeah. How many people cannot feed themselves?
Yeah.
So Gaddafi was not a problem to Libyans.
You know, I have to interject here for just a sec, because, you know, coming from the West, I knew nothing. And being here, I'm learning slowly about what is really going on. And when it came to Gaddafi in Libya, we in the West have been virtually brainwashed through propaganda that he was just a bad, evil man that required destruction, and didn't realize that he was actually a very benevolent dictator in many ways.
Yes.
And that's, you know, we could even go further and talk about Saddam Hussein, who had complete control of what was going on in his own country.
Yes.
Then he was taken out, and now we have all these problems with ISIS and everything
even,
else.
And even Congo, they killed PLO Lumumba. Mm. Congo has never known peace. Mm. Meanwhile, they are stealing minerals from that country. So the West is not genuine in its operation with Africa.
Mm-hmm. And you know, something to add to that too is we got to remember that a lot of these policies put in place is government-owned.
Yeah.
We have to remember that people are generally innocent within a country, and they are only as educated and fed information, or they're fed information based on what the requirement is. And so a lot of people like myself that are part of the general public are completely ignorant of what goes on in these countries.
Yeah, that's true.
And we're fed information from our governments and through the media, of course. The media plays a big part in that.
Yeah.
And when we actually educate people, you know, it doesn't necessarily change minds, but it can change perceptions, you know, if that is the correct term. You know, it's really woken me up to the fact that the world is not what it seems. You know, if you get out and travel and you sit down with people that offer these other perceptions, opinions, you know, the world now then opens up and you're going, oh my goodness.
It's true.
You know, we really need to understand that knowledge is power.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter what part of the world you come from. So, yeah, everything you've said is, you know, it's certainly an eye-opener, and I hope it's an eye-opener for people that will be listening to this broadcast.
Mm. And by the way, you talk about that Africa, there's no democracy. What just happened in the United States? What just happened in the United States?
Well, that's democracy at its best. The people voted, and they voted in a man called Donald Trump.
Yes. And if they voted the man called Donald Trump, what are all those protests?
That is democracy. That is democracy at its best. What the final result will be of that, we don't know yet.
Really? I think the West need to be honest. You look at other Western leaders, what they are saying about, even the West is split about their own democracy. And, you know, it's split. And you look at it, I think the problem of the West has been a color problem.
Mm.
The West thinks in terms of color first. And those are the lenses that needs to be changed.
Well, color and obviously religion now. Right, the minorities.
And of course, religion now.
Yeah.
But color is predominant.
Mm, yeah.
You look at things that are going viral on internet about Donald Trump chucking out a journalist from his own forum from not asking a question.
That's right. And doesn't that suggest how fragile human rights are, depending on who we vote into office?
Exactly. Human rights are very fragile.
The United States is the epitome of human rights, or, you know, they once were, and hopefully they still will be. Mm. I mean, they've had a democracy for hundreds of years, or at least the West has, and all of a sudden you vote in one person who is, we could say, a dictator, and is going ahead and, you know, changing the rules. And yes, everybody's up in arms. I mean, he's had a number...
But he's only changing those rules because the person who facilitated that progress is not of his color. It's not that he disagree with those rules. It's not that he disagree entirely with, for example, the healthcare.
Mm.
No, it's because the person who initiated that was not of his color. Nothing more.
Well, and you got to realize, too, that I want to say a majority, but, you know, if we had to split it down the middle, there's a lot of people who do not support him.
Oh, of course.
But I think it goes back to the same statement is, you know, they wanted a change. They voted him in accordance to the democratic process, and that's what they got.
I think we wish America well. We wish America well. We would want to see America do well. But we'd also want to say, Donald Trump is saying that his business is America.
Mm.
We also want our business to be Kenya. So let him not interfere with Africa. We will not we never interfere with the U.S. anyway. Why should they interfere with us?
Yeah.
But
when you talk about interference, though, what do you mean by interference? Are we talking about funding?
We are talking about funding. We are talking about irrational policies that are made for us to fit into. And I think it should not interfere with us. In fact, the U.S., amongst other Western countries, owe us. And they should treat us knowing that they owe us. They owe us labor, 400 years worth of labor. They owe us, they've theft from us. They owe us a lot. Yeah. So, and I think we need to present them with a bill very soon.
That goes back to the old, political agenda around, again, global aid and what that actually stands for. Mm. Maybe we should touch on that for a little bit here. I know we're kind of going over 20 and 30 minutes, but for me this is an interesting subject, and I really appreciate your patience in all of this. But, the one thing I know that I've learned over a short period of time is, although the International Monetary Fund, or the IMF, was originally started, to help, Eastern Bloc countries in Europe get a footing again after World War II, and then they decided to hop over to Africa, to impose their policies with the idea that they were doing a good thing in getting the economy going, and it's wound up in this revolving problem of aid and poverty and aid and poverty, and it's been going on for the last 50 years. Mm. But one thing that I have learned is that, the more money developing countries borrow, the more they have to pay back. And in result of that, a lot of fundamental programs from within these countries are cut short of funding because of the payback scheme in place. Mm. I'm just wondering if you might be able to add to that.
Let me ask you. IMF knows very well that these loans cannot be paid. They keep on writing off this debt. Then why should they keep on giving loans? They write off this debt. So why give them?
That's a pretty hard question.
Yes,
right?
And I think we have demonstrated far and above that ideas that are generated from the West cannot come and be implemented in Africa. They tried with the structural adjustment programs, failed terribly, because it does not fit into the African context. Mm-hmm. The terms that we are given these loans with cannot work for us. The people, the African people, are excluded in formulating programs on how they can implement.
Especially through the WTO,
exactly.
The World Trade Organization.
Yes. And in my opinion, Africa can survive, particularly without donor aid. In Kenya, there was a time that President Moi survived for about 4 years without donor aid, and Kenya did not die. I am sure we can survive without donor aid. President Kibaki tried to limit donor aid to a certain extent, and Kenya had the best economy in his time. I am sure that we can survive without donor aid. As Kenyans, we can survive. We are hardworking people. We are committed people. We are industrious. We can survive. You look at what donor aid does, it kills our industries. At the moment, we hardly have any local industry that is thriving. The last probably would have been the sugar cane industry. It's also collapsing. Why? Because of a lot of imports, and much of these imports come in form of relief. And this one is killing us.
And there's no tax base.
And there's no tax base. Mm-hmm. You get it. I think that for a while as a country, we need to reflect. And I even urge our leaders that we need to reflect for posterity's sake. If Africa is to exist on the surface of this world, we need to generate our own and consume our own.
I got a quick question for you. What is trade like amongst African countries?
It is very poor. It is not well regulated. And there's a lot of mistrust within African countries because of the belief that anything that comes from the West is superior. So African countries have been made to look at each other as dwarfs.
Okay. How would you fix that? Could you fix it?
Yes, it could be fixed. It could be fixed by Africans. One is we need the African Union should not survive on funding from UN. It should be autonomous in its existence. The regional blocs, ECOWAS, East African Community, should also seek some autonomy. And I think that is the way to go. Once these blocks, these economic blocks are autonomous, then we can survive as Africa.